a trauma-informed lens can really go a long way to kind of mitigating and impacting the trajectory that someone will take after that.
Hello, everyone. I am Isis Garcia Rodriguez, and this is TikTok. Trauma-informed care provides a framework to support resilience by moving away from a problem-focused model in which we ask what's wrong with you to a strengths-based perspective where we ask what happened to you. In an attempt to reach all audiences, the MGBTIC initiative is using the TikTok podcast platform to continue education and disseminate information on trauma-informed care for healthcare providers, patients, educators, and community members. Each week on TikTok, we will be discussing different topics in the healthcare field and looking at them through a trauma-informed lens. For a comprehensive list of the 6 TIC guiding principles and 3 implementation domains, according to SAMHSA, please see the 2 graphics that can be found on Twitter or listen to episode 1 of this podcast. During this episode, we would like to discuss resilience and the impact trauma has on brain health. With me today is someone new to the show, Dr. Nomi Levy-Carrick. She is the Associate Vice Chair of Ambulatory Services in the Department of Psychiatry at Brigham and Women's Hospital. She's also the co-chair of the Mass General Brigham Trauma-Informed Care Initiative, an assistant professor in psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, and also Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Clinical Scholar Fellow. She currently is a clinical psychiatrist specializing in developing programs to incorporate a trauma-informed perspective across medical and psychiatric care domains. Nomi's abiding research is for interventions that support health equity initiatives to optimize individuals' long-term functional outcomes across the lifespan. So Nomi, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me.
Pleasure to be here.
Awesome. So we'll dive right in. This is a really interesting topic for me, and I know for you as well. So can you tell me a little bit about how we can or you conceptualize resilience?
Sure. Resilience is really an umbrella term that captures a series of associated traits that help somebody regain equilibrium after they've undergone some sort of stressor. And so you can think of it as having kind of an inner core of physical components and an outer core of different kind of coping skills. And so at one level, you know, we need to have good nutrition and sleep and hydration and exercise and some capacity to relax. And the other component is really maintaining some sense of optimism, your attitude toward life, an emotional awareness, a sense of social control, a sense of humor, and really important is social supports and your social network and the ability to problem solve. So all those components are also there. You know, these are nonlinear, they're bidirectional. For some people, if you haven't had a good night's sleep, nothing else falls into place. For some people, unless you've had a really meaningful day and social connection in that, it's really hard to go to sleep at night. And so the ways in which one can be resilient are very multidimensional. And that gives us a lot of opportunities for helping to understand where people's resilience actually can be found and can be nurtured.
Yeah, I really love that. Even in the question of conceptualizing resilience and you naming that there are multiple different kind of avenues in which someone can be resilient, because generally in the science, you know, we want a definition. And how do we define resilience? And what is this one answer? And what you're saying is that there's a lot of different ways to talk about this. And it could be very individual as well.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, at its core, there's the definition that comes from the physics, right? It kind of will bend, not bounce in the face of pressure, but bend, not break in the face of pressure. But the way that we think about it, particularly in trauma-informed frame or in a human frame, it sort of does justice to human complexity by thinking of it a little bit more multidimensional.
Yeah, and obviously, you know, when we're thinking about resilience, people can generally be resilient, but you know, what you're also saying is in the face of XYZ. And so when we think about resilience, we're also thinking about stress and trauma.
Right, exactly.
So with all that being said, how does your specific understanding of neurobiology inform your perspective in applications of trauma-informed care in this area of resiliency?
A really interesting question. I think, you know, a lot of what we've learned about how things work is by studying it when it doesn't work. And so one of the things that we've learned about PTSD is that there are multiple nerve circuits that are implicated in the brain when we think about what's going on when someone has had a trauma, has had an experience that so overwhelms them that it kind of encodes itself in a way that can almost stop time and can result in a whole variety of different symptoms that are really disruptive to life. That's kind of on the one side. And then, you know, I think it's always worth adding that brain and mind and body are totally connected. And so there's, of course, the sort of fight, flight, freeze response, but it's all kind of starting in the brain, those cascades. So one way to sort of conceptualize it is to recognize that there are these four domains: emotion regulation and executive functioning, threat and salience detection, contextual processing, and fear learning. So one thing we know is that emotion regulation and executive functioning are tightly interrelated. And so if somebody is emotionally dysregulated, for example, their executive function goes down a lot. And that has real implications for when when somebody does kind of go into this fight, flight, freeze response, for example, or feels really emotionally dysregulated, the way we speak to people, the way they're understanding what is going on is going to be different. We're not going to see them at their best selves, at their most effective selves at this moment. Put another way, the more that someone can feel some control over their emotion regulation, the more that they can get that executive functioning back online and really navigate the world as effectively as they can. A second domain is threat and salience detection. And so we all have different set points for what we find threatening. And that's based on, you know, all these different components of our lived experience, our genetics, our epigenetics. And so understanding the ways in which that sort of lays the groundwork for the way somebody's navigating the world is a really valuable and important thing. And what it means is that in an organizational setting, for example, we want to think about how do we create space and create dialogue that makes people feel safe, feel not threatened. And that takes some really proactive, intentional work to do. Another domain is fear learning. And we know that we have those fears, those traumas that leave a mark in a way in the amygdala that is very strong. It encodes in a way that really informs all of your other networks. And so that kind of can help us understand why some memories actually end up being so strong and so inform our perspective, as opposed to others that are, come less to mind. The fourth domain is contextual processing. And I find this absolutely fascinating. The way that we take all the bits of our lived experience and integrate it into our narrative is super important. Contextual processing, Arshe Levin, his team once described, I'm paraphrasing, but you know, if you see an alligator in a zoo, then you think it's really interesting and you're exciting to see. If you open the door and you see an alligator in your backyard, you're going to have a very different response, or at least you should have a different response, because the context of where that's happening matters. And contextual processing happens during REM sleep. And, you know, we know how often sleep disruption can happen as both, you know, in the context of and as a symptom of trauma. And that can also help us understand sort of one of the vulnerabilities and also one of the important symptom targets when something happens. that is, you know, potentially traumatic. So, but that contextual processing piece, we can talk about a little bit more. It really helps inform the way that I think about different approaches to try and kind of prophylax against a difficult situation or a potentially traumatic event actually sort of progressing to one that is that sort of meets criteria for a stress disorder, for example.
So do you think you could give me an example, Nomi, of how you apply the trauma-informed care principles, you know, whether it be through those four domains, but just generally within this area and how you engage with patients in their specific medical care?
Sure. I think I'm going to take it in two parts. The first is to really think about those four domains that we spoke about and how that maps on to those six principles. And for example, in trauma-informed care, we talk about safety, and it's physical and psychological safety. And when we think about that sort of threat salience piece, it kind of makes sense, and it's quite powerful if you recognize what might be driving people's sense of safety. It also means that somebody coming into a health center, a patient really needs to feel safe if they're going to have a positive experience, if they're going to be able to kind of get the most out of whatever that medical encounter is. Trustworthiness and transparency speaks a lot to the kind of sense of the salience system and also safety. Those are kind of intersecting. And then when we look at collaboration and mutuality and empowerment, I think that you can tie that closely to the executive functioning and emotional regulation part. You know, if somebody's feeling super dysregulated, then telling them that you'd like to collaborate with them on your treatment planning and giving them all sorts of, you know, risks, benefits, and alternatives to treatments is, you know, it's not an ideal context in which they're going to be able to really feel empowered to be part of that conversation. Peer support is another crucial domain, and peer support is helpfully understood as a piece of contextual processing, as is, of course, sort of cultural, historical, race, gender acknowledgement. It's sort of twofold. One is recognizing that there's something very special about being with someone or discussing an experience with someone who's shared that with you. That there is that healing comes from many different directions, and we don't want to miss the importance of the possibilities of that healing from within social networks in all our different intersectional identities. And so when I'm taking care of patients, part of the way it might inform things is, you know, from even before I walk out of my office door, I want to think about, you know, what are the different experiences they had just leaving home to get to me, or now, you know, post-COVID in many cases, this is telehealth. And now I'm thinking about their safety in different ways, right? Are they safe at home? Do they have privacy in the context in which they're doing that session? And so by being really explicit in running through those, it's helpful for me to ensure that I'm attending to all of this kind of context beyond just being sort of symptom focused. The trustworthiness and transparency, I try to ensure that, you know, very clear about my role, about what's going to happen during a session. And just as we would apply in a physical exam, you say what you're going to do before you do it, right? Say it before you do it, talk before you touch. And even in a psychiatric interview, I spend some time at the beginning talking about, you know, we're going to run through a little bit of history. We're going to try and understand not just your experience, but what are some of the symptoms that are bothering you now. And then, you know, we'll see how much more there is to learn, what we can get done today, and slowly develop a treatment plan together that kind of makes sense. And I found that sort of helping people understand what's going to happen within that period can also really be quite helpful, because otherwise you're kind of going in blind. And I think, you know, even me as a patient, when I'm walking, you know, through an experience and not sure of it, it creates this level of stress and hypervigilance that that doesn't need to be there by being transparent. And then, you know, I want to also in there create space to really, and again, it trust happens over time. And so in some ways we have to kind of establish trust relatively quickly in a medical encounter, but I think it's also recognizing that not everything has to happen in that first session. We want people to feel sort of comfortable saying as much or as little as they're comfortable with in those encounters. And leaving some space for understanding how their culture or their race or their gender sort of informs their experience, because it can be, there are some general understandings that we have around structural racism and all these other kind of, we used to call them microaggressions, but they're macroaggressions too. But people's individual experience with that is really also important to attend to, and sort of remaining curious and trying to sort of bring some authenticity to the questions can sometimes create space for collaboration, but also again attending to the sort of sense of safety, psychological safety as well.
Super helpful. I mean, you definitely touched on a lot of the six principles, and not only integrated it into, you know, what you even spoke about today, but just generally what that looks like, you know, through the application. So that's awesome. So in closing, Nomi, do you think that there's maybe one little nugget or one take-home message that you would like the listeners to take away from today's episode, whether it be regarding resiliency or trauma or brain health or trauma-informed care or the four domains? I mean, we touched on a lot. So what would that be for you?
I think one important piece of this whole trauma-informed enterprise is really to understand that not all adversity leads to trauma, not all trauma leads to PTSD, and that a trauma-informed lens can really go a long way to kind of mitigating and impacting the trajectory that someone will take after that. Certainly in the medical setting, when we sort of think about preventable medical, trauma that's occurring in the medical setting. So many people will be resilient, and they'll be the more resilient if we attend to coping skills that they've already developed, or we help them build some along the way. And some people, you know, when we think about resilience as bouncing back, and some people will bounce higher. And there's the path to post-traumatic growth that we think about, that as people, they pass the fear zone and go through a learning zone and end up in this growth zone. And post-traumatic growth, or PTG, really can mean that somebody just has a personal strength that they never knew they had in them before, or they relate to others in a different way. Many people will just describe a newfound appreciation for life, and that it really opens up new possibilities for the things they can do. And some people have real spiritual changes that are also associated with that. And so really recognizing that by being trauma-informed, we can support the resilience of individuals, of the interpersonal engagements we have, of our organizations, that we really can make an impact in people's trajectory, and hence, you know, in people's quality of life.
Very beautifully said, Nomi. So thank you so much for that nugget, as well as just all of the amazing information that you've provided to me and to the listeners today. So thank you again for today.
Thank you so much, Isis, for doing this.
Make sure to rate us and leave comments for things that you like, or even some topics that you'd like to see us cover. But until then, we'll be counting down the minutes on TikTok.